Okay, thank you, Graham, for that very interesting presentation and keynote. So it's given us some things to think about. We've got 15 minutes for questions, folk. Let me just remind you that please put your hand up. If I acknowledge you, then stand up and present your question to Graham. Any questions? Yes, or comment at the back, please. Can you give us your name as well, please?
Graham Murray from the University of Newcastle.
Thank you, Graham.
I'm just curious, 20% of do get attended to, which 20%? Are they the most needy, or are they the most vulnerable, or the most convenient, or how is that
distributed? Very good question. I mean, in some ways, it kind of highlights one of the other conversations that is going on in the sector. And in fact, one of the sessions this afternoon does, one of the breakout sessions does touch on this, which is around sort of the regulatory barriers to shelter. I would argue that one, because there is this lack of common recognition and understanding of diverse forms of tenure, that a large majority of people who have very informal, poorly defined forms of tenure probably do not receive assistance. So I think we probably end up split between those, you know, perhaps I argue within that 20%, but perhaps you know, a proportion of them just receive very basic assistance. You know, very much is that kind of basic relief immediately after disaster. And those who receive longer term assistance are those who perhaps have more definable forms of tenure.
Okay.
I was just interested in the in your discussion. Thank you very much for that. It was really interesting. But the focus a fair amount on disasters, and I wonder how we raise the profile of shelter outside of the disaster situation, in the sense that we know there's increasing urbanisation. We know that's not being coped with very well in a number of developing countries. To my mind, that's a growing disaster. It might be a slower disaster than a tsunami or whatever else, but it's certainly becoming a disaster, and how we can get into those more early stages, if you like.
Yeah, no, thank you, John. It's very true that you know, I certainly sort of focus more around disaster. I think probably, you know, one of the challenges is that outside of disaster, of course, the development agenda, I mean, it clearly is national. You know, it's a government issue. The sheer, you know, scale in terms of cost, you know, the politicisation of it, I mean, it is a governmental issue. I think we all recognise, I mean, that's the figure I didn't refer to, is that, you know, that there are probably still, you know, a billion people on the planet who lack adequate housing as defined, you know, through the rights language. So it is a huge challenge. However, I think this is where the connection back in some of what I talked about is quite relevant, which is, you know, where are the resources? You know, where's the opportunity? It is national level. It is governments, you know, if they can be properly made aware, you know, of this issue. It is the private sector. Now, again, I use that term quite loosely to mean the various forms of finance capital that's available to people. The various enterprises enable the business of housing to happen, you know, through, you know, again, it could be local craftsmen, it could be, you know, medium-sized companies. I think one of the challenges we face, and I think we probably all experience this, if you go around the world, quite often, the business of housing is split between different line ministries. You know, if you're in a metropolitan area, there will probably be someone dealing with, you know, urban issues. It's not necessarily housing. You know, I often compare it to the health sector. In most countries, there's a Ministry of Health dealing with health. You know, there's not always a Ministry of Housing. In the UK, where I come from, there's no Ministry for Housing. You know, I live in Switzerland. There's no Ministry for Housing. So I think we do face a challenge in the fact that the business of housing is incredibly fragmented. And that's exactly the same problem we face in disasters. I mean, well, I think one angle we take as IFRC is that the disasters do provide an entry point to try and ensure there's a more coherent conversation around housing going forward on the developmental agenda. It doesn't address the whole housing backlog, and I quite agree. But I think that is something which, I mean, it'd be interesting to hear, you know, in terms of the context in Australia, where clearly there are housing issues, certainly with indigenous populations, but many others, I'm sure, in the sort of peri-urban areas. So it'd be interesting to see from the context of Australia how that's being addressed, because I think there are often we're a little bit blind to, you know, the solutions are actually kind of on our doorstep. Not necessarily always good ones. Some of the things we shouldn't do, we're doing, and we shouldn't replicate elsewhere, but some of the success stories are actually here, and we just need to translate them. I would argue they are not a developmental... it's not sort of development in the traditional way, and I think some of we get a bit of a blockage in terms of it's top down, it's people with experience of communities. Not necessarily so. Maybe it's people who've worked in regeneration, you know, in some of the, I don't know, former industrial areas of cities. They are the people, the expertise that actually need to be talking to, you know, the people in Mexico City or Rio, in terms of their experience to see how to address, you know, the housing issue, because it's not just about housing, it's about economy, it's about access, it's about, you know, getting recognition of people's status, except to enable the business of housing. But it's a, you know, it is a challenging issue. Thank you for raising it.
Yes, please.
Thank you for the question, because I think it is something that needs a lot more airtime.
Excuse me, did the folk at the back hear that question? You did. Okay, good.
Yes. Well, I would argue it has increased in, say, the last decade, or has become a lot more evident. I mean, it's something I think we have to keep reminding ourselves, or rather, my logistics colleagues are always reminding me that 70% of the turnover of the International Federation of Red Cross is through procurement. Okay? Mm. And that's procurement of stuff through the private sector. It's a commercial activity. We put out a bid and companies tender for it. It's commercial. Okay? So a lot of the business that we do, you know, it's a language issue. I think we have to be a little bit careful in terms of the language, in terms of, you know, what is seen as private sector and what is seen as humanitarian. In terms of the actors, which I think is more of your question, who's involved, I think certainly, yes, there has been a shift. I mean, partly that's been government-led. I mean, I have to say the US government were one of those, you know, who, you know, 10 years ago made a big shift towards, forget working direct with NGOs, just, you know, work through two or three big American contractors. And I think it's interesting that's the word they use, not building contractor, but they contract out the work, full stop. So that's always been there. I think what we have seen a difference in, and it's interesting you coming from Arabs, is, I suppose, is perhaps non-traditional private sector actors starting to see, you know, the extent to which there is work in humanitarianism. But one comment on that, which I suppose is a trend which I perhaps welcome less, which is where some of the private sector actors are basically reinventing themselves as humanitarian agencies. Mm. Well, let me give you an example that I encountered. I mean, I was approached a few years ago by ArcelorMittal, who, as you probably know, is the biggest steel company, or second biggest steel company on the planet. And basically what they wanted to do was persuade me that they could produce steel houses that Red Cross could use in emergencies. And I said, well, thank you very much, but I've never yet been asked for, like, a steel house. And thank you for, you know, telling me what I should know. My preference would be for you, ArcelorMittal, to work at how you get standard steel sections to remote locations as quickly as you possibly can through your existing network. You know, it's a commercial business for you. To what extent can you work through, you know, your various suppliers to get that kind of stuff out there so that agencies or indeed householders then have the resources to do their bit of the process? In other words, my point being, what we don't want is the private sector to try and reinvent themselves as humanitarian agencies. I mean, that's really doesn't help us whatsoever. It's how do we through complementarity of effort have a bigger impact? And I do see that as a bit of a challenge. I mean, most of the private sector companies I'm approached with, and we have an ongoing dialogue with some 11 multinationals, basically they just want to be humanitarian, and it's really difficult to say, just do what you do, but look at recalibrating it so that it actually, you know, is better attuned to addressing the situation in either a relief context or a development context, where perhaps, you know, you may need to adjust the numbers, or adjust quite how you do business, but don't significantly change your business. Thank you very much.
I'm just wondering if whether any of these sort of the views of super philanthropists like the Bill Gates, whether that's an area that's shelter area's been impacted on yet.
We're trying. let me share one example which I think highlights part of the dilemma. And this is where, I mean, in some ways, my previous answer, you know, is reflected in that. In that, unfortunately, they try and do too much of thinking themselves before beginning the dialogue. So, for example, IKEA, who I think we're all familiar with, the IKEA Foundation, decided they wanted to produce a house. They decided that. They didn't come and say, right, you know, what are the kind of the needs? But so they want to produce a house. In fact, we've stepped out of that conversation. UNHCR are still in that conversation. And so they produced a temporary house. Now, my argument is, as Red Cross, we don't stock temporary housing. Oh, we stock materials and tools on a large scale, but we very rarely, you know, have the money, you know, to provide individual housing to an individual household. I mean, going back to this number of the, you know, 20% get assistance, 80% do not. It's very hard to justify, you know, giving one household a $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 housing solution. There are occasions, what I call the niche emergencies, cold climate, technological disasters, for example, where you do need that solution. But it's addressing the needs of the few. So for me, it's a slightly kind of misleading conversation. I mean, the conversation we're trying to kind of restart with IKEA is, right, fantastic distribution network, you know, their focus on, you know, componentry, brilliant. You know, their communication style, brilliant. The use of local markets to source their product, brilliant. How can we, you know, tap into that and enable that? Not to produce a house, but to enable, you know, a local economy to support people who are trying to build. But so far, it's been almost impossible to get them to even recognise that that's a conversation worth having. And so that's a little bit the problem, you know, with some of the others. I suppose one other big challenge we face is that, and this actually is way beyond this Q&A session, which was the fact that our sector is so poorly understood. It's so vast. If we all went to, you know, wrote down a piece of paper to define our sector, I'm sure we'd have 30, 40 different sort of definitions. You know, I mean, I use the word built environment. I've used it a few times this morning because I think I'm in an audience that understand that phrase. But I use that with my health colleagues, and they're not quite sure. I mean, typically I say, well, it's everything that doesn't grow. And then, oh, all right, you know, because they think shelter, oh, it's about providing a housing solution. They don't realise it's these other complex issues, which is our challenge. I do believe if, you know, the Gates Foundation or others, you know, could be got onto our wavelength. I mean, I always say this sector, you know, is crying out for a shelter champion, whether it be private sector, big foundation. You know, at some point, I think it will happen. And we've got a few kind of in and around, but they're not quite there yet. I mean, just one last aside. Interestingly, in November, as Red Cross, Red Crescent, every 2 years we have our General Assembly, bring all our national societies together. And in fact, it's happening in Sydney in November. And in fact, the Gates Foundation are coming as a keynote speaker. We actually have shelter on the agenda. So, of course, I'm thinking, right, one of those kind of cocktail sessions. I don't know whether it's going to be Bill himself, but one of those cocktail sessions. Boy, you know, I'm going to try and use it to bend somebody's ear. But maybe that's a mission for all of us. You know, we need to go and keep going out there and representing our sector and try and hook one of those fish that could really perhaps help, you know, move our message forward.
Okay, thank you, Graham. We've come to the end of the